Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Somalian authorities arrest a major al-Shabaab commander, and Ukraine and Russian prisoner exchanges continue. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Somalian authorities say they have captured one of the most wanted al-Shabaab commanders. Zakaria Ismail Hersi was captured this morning in the town of Al-Waq near the Kenyan border. General Abbas Ibrahim Guri, the commander of Somali government troops in the region, told VOA's Somali service authorities received a tip that al-Shabaab suspects were hiding in a house. Hersi was captured with his secretary and put up no resistance during the raid. In an interview with VOA while in custody, Hersi himself confirmed he was a member of al-Shabaab and said he left the group 18 months ago and never was the group's intelligence chief, as had been earlier reported. Ivory Coast former First Lady Simone Gbagbo went on trial under heavy security in Abidjan Friday for her alleged role in stealing the 2010 election and resisting efforts to dislodge her husband in the civil war that followed. Simone Gbagbo and 82 others faced charges after her husband, former President Laurent Gbagbo, was driven from the presidency in 2011. Mr. Gbagbo lost the 2010 vote to Alassane Ouattara, but declared himself the winner. He was driven from power by rebels and a French-led international force, but more than 3,000 people died in the resulting civil war. Several more Ukrainian prisoners are to be handed over to Kiev today by pro-Russian separatists one day after the two sides exchanged hundreds. The exchange completes the prisoner swap. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko's office said that Ukraine handed over 222 rebel captives on Friday and welcomed home 146 Ukrainian servicemen in the largest exchange since the uprising began in April. This is VOA News. A group monitoring the conflict in Syria says government airstrikes have killed at least 37 civilians in Syria, in an area controlled by Islamic State fighters. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says 7 children and 2 women were among the dead in the attack on Al-Bab and the nearby town of Kabasin. Meanwhile, U.S. and partner nation military forces on Friday conducted airstrikes in Syria against the Islamic State targets near Kobani and 5 coalition airstrikes against the Islamic State militants in Iraq. Pakistan's military says security forces have ambushed a large assembly of terrorists near the border with Afghanistan, killing at least 16, wounding 20 others. The government is focusing an intense anti-terror campaign on all militant outfits operating in the country without distinguishing between good and bad Taliban. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
Since the visit of new Afghan President Ashraf Ghani to Pakistan last month, both sides have reported increased economic and security cooperation to promote regional peace efforts. Pakistani advisor on national security and foreign policy, Sartaj Aziz, says that Islamabad swiftly shared evidence on the handlers in Afghanistan after the recent attack on a military-run school in Peshawar, and Afghan authorities responded appropriately.
This was the first sort of event which called upon that mechanism to come into place. So there were very high-level exchanges between the two countries, and therefore coordinated action was taken.
The United States also acknowledges the positive trend and increased cooperation and has promised to continue its support in bringing the two even closer. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Azerbaijan police have raided the Baku Bureau of U.S. government-funded Radio Free Europe early Friday, shutting down the office and ordering its journalists to stop work. The RFE chief editor called the raid a flagrant violation of every international commitment and standard Azerbaijan has pledged to uphold, and told VOA officials from the state prosecutor's office took documents and questioned staff members into Friday evening. The broadcasters have received no details on why their organization was targeted. North Korea is accusing the United States of being responsible for internet outages experienced in recent days amid a dispute between the two countries about the hacking of the film studio Sony Pictures and its website. The North's powerful National Defense Commission, the country's top governing body led by Kim Jong-un, released a statement today accusing Washington of a complete internet outage that lasted around 9 hours and causing as well the intermittent outages early in the week. The outage came after President Barack Obama said the U.S. would retaliate for what Washington said is North Korea's hacking of the Sony Picture website. And Vice President Joe Biden and New York Mayor Bill de Blasio are expected to attend today's funeral for one of 2 New York City police officers gunned down while sitting in their squad car last week. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
To speak with sincerely, there is no very, very charge against her.
A defense attorney says charges against former Ivorian First Lady are politically motivated.
The sanctioning of UN personnel and the order to expel them is unacceptable. These two senior UN officials were sent to Sudan to carry out their duty.
Sudan expels two senior United Nations officials from the country. We'll have a reaction from the UN.
These are our officers who are going to, they are an advance party actually, who are going to prepare the whole process of the printing of ballot papers.
And a team comprising civil society and political parties will monitor the printing of ballot papers to be used for the upcoming Zambian presidential by-election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Rodrigue Dadje is the attorney for Simone Gbagbo, wife of Ivory Coast's former President Laurent Gbagbo. He says he plans to petition the court to release the former First Lady from 3 years under house arrest next week. Mrs. Gbagbo is charged with attempting to undermine the country's security because of her alleged role in the 2010 post-election violence that left about 3,000 people dead. For more on the charges, I reached Mr. Dadje in the commercial capital, Abidjan.
For Madame Gbagbo to speak with sincerely, there is no very, very charge against her. It's a political attack only. It's a political attack. If you read the decision of the CPI and the last decision of the CPI against the reject of the demand of the government on Ivory Coast, you will see that the CPI analyze the claim, this actual claim for the Assise in French, and says that there is no charge about against Madame Gbagbo.
So you think the charges are politically motivated? Why do you say that?
Because you see, you are in a specific matter. When you are something due, there is a fact. It's the fact we can analyze and say that this fact is the infraction of crime, the infraction of stealing, and so on and so on. In this claim, there is no fact against Madame Gbagbo. Nobody can tell to Madame Gbagbo, one day, at February, at January, at March, you did something like that, and this action is an infraction. Do you understand?
I understand, Mr. Dadje, but the government is saying that she was part of the reason why so many Ivorians were killed during the post-election violence in Ivory Coast, so she is accountable for the death of Ivorians. As his lawyer, what do you say to that?
I say that it's a political position, because you are not in political claim. You are now in a juridical claim. And juridical claim, you have to have proof. There is no proof in this claim against Madame Gbagbo. Do you understand? There is no proof. I can tell you today and tomorrow, there is no proof in this claim.
So if there's no proof, are you going to ask the judge to dismiss the case against Madame Gbagbo?
Of course. We are waiting for this claim since 3 years. Do you understand? And it's the time of the time. Now you are in the claim, and the national opinion and international opinion will be testimony to see the reality of this claim. There is nothing against Madame Gbagbo. And I will ask to the judge to relax Madame Gbagbo. I will demand the releasing of Madame Gbagbo, because there is no fact, there is no proof against her. She can stay in the jail during 3 years for nothing. I'm sorry.
Rodrigue Daje is the defense attorney for Simone Gbagbo, the former First Lady of Ivory Coast. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Abidjan. Sudan has ordered two top UN officials to leave the country less than a month after President Omar Hassan al-Bashir told UN peacekeepers from the joint UN-African Union mission in Darfur, or UNAMID, to prepare an exit strategy. The warning came after Sudanese soldiers were accused of being involved in a mass rape in Thabit, a village in Darfur. For reaction, VOA South Sudan in Focus reporter Carol Van Dam interviewed UN spokesman Stefan Dujarric in New York, who says the UN has filed a protest with the government of Sudan.
The sanctioning of UN personnel and the order to expel them is unacceptable. These two senior UN officials were sent to Sudan to carry out their duties in accordance with the United Nations Charter. From our standpoint, we condemn the decision and we call on the government to reverse it.
Is this even legal? Can they take this action and forcibly expel these two officials?
Any government has the sovereign right to do this. And if the order goes through and is not reversed, these two people will obviously have to leave Sudan. But it is something that we are calling on for the government to reverse, to reconsider, and to cooperate fully with all UN entities are currently working in Sudan.
As you know, Sudanese soldiers in Thabit, a village in Darfur, were accused of mass rape not that long ago, and the United Nations staff there in Sudan were trying to conduct their own investigation. Do you believe this has something to do with that?
I think you would have to ask the Sudanese as to what is government, as to what you would have to ask the Sudanese government as to what is motivating them to act in this way and to enact these decisions. We are continuing; our peacekeeping mission is continuing to try to gain access to that town. The issue of the freedom of movement of peacekeeping personnel of the joint mission has been an issue recently and continues to be an issue recently, and we expect from the Sudanese authorities full freedom of movement for our peacekeeping personnel.
Late last month, I was able to speak to the Sudanese ambassador to the United Nations, and he was very strong in his opinion that these soldiers did not take part in the alleged mass rape, and that he claims the United Nations personnel that are already in Sudan were given access to this village. However, they were accompanied by the very same Sudanese soldiers that were accused of this rape. Is that your recollection of events?
It is my understanding that there was some very initial contact in the town, but what we are asking for is for full unfettered access, both peacekeeping and other UN personnel, to be able to assess what actually happened, because obviously allegations of rape are very serious, and we take them very seriously, and we need to investigate them.
And so far, just to set the record straight, the UN personnel have not been able to get back to that village.
No, they have not been able to.
For an independent investigation.
That's correct.
Where do things stand now? Does that mean that all the UN personnel have to leave Sudan?
No, this is and first of all, I think we need to understand these are two separate entities. You have, on one hand, UNAMID, which is the joint UN-AU peacekeeping mission, which works in Darfur. The two senior UN officials, the resident coordinator and the country director for the UNDP, are based in Khartoum and are completely separate from the peacekeeping mission. These are UN people who work and operate.
Right, namely Ali Al-Zatari, the UN resident coordinator of the UN Development Program, and Yvonne Hell, UNDP's country director.
Exactly. Now, obviously, you know, there is a strategic review ongoing of the UN peacekeeping mission in Darfur, which will be delivered to the Security Council in February. As part of the mandated review by the Security Council, we are looking at exit strategy options for the mission. But as you know, the presence of a peacekeeping mission, of any UN peacekeeping mission, is decided upon by the Security Council, and we operate under a mandate granted to us by the Security Council.
Stefan Dujarric is the spokesman for the United Nations. He spoke with South Sudan in Focus reporter Carol Van Dam from New York. The spokesman for the Electoral Commission of Zambia, ECZ, says representatives from political parties and stakeholders, including civil society and faith-based groups, will be traveling to South Africa on Sunday. They will monitor the printing of the ballot papers that will be used for the upcoming presidential by-election. Spokesman Chris Akufuna told me that an advanced team of officials from the Electoral Commission left Zambia to South Africa last week to prepare the grounds ahead of the trip from the political parties and the stakeholders.
The team that left yesterday to Johannesburg is a team of officers from the Electoral Commission of Zambia and not government officers. These are our officers who are going to, they are an advance party actually, who are going to prepare the whole process of the printing of ballot papers before the stakeholders, which comprises the political parties participating in this election, civil society representatives, representatives of the church and faith-based organizations, and the Zambia police, and the Anti-Corruption Commission, and the Drug Enforcement Commission. These stakeholders will travel on Sunday, the 28th, and they will join our officers.
Talking about the Drug Enforcement Commission, some people are raising suspicions, saying that their inclusion could possibly be that the ruling party is trying to use them to rig the vote. That is the suspicion that some people I spoke to talked about. How do you address this issue?
Well, we have in the past, I think there are precedents to this. In 2006, they were part of the team of officials that joined us. In 2008, they were part of the team, and indeed in 2011. So it's nothing strange. We have worked with them before in terms of the Zambia Police, the Anti-Corruption Commission, and the Drug Enforcement Commission. They have been part of this process, overseeing the whole printing process, or rather observing. So they have been part. There is nothing suspicious about them being included. But of course, some stakeholders would want to perhaps say, but why include them? They have been part of it from the past.
Talking about the sake of transparency, accountability, and credibility of the election, what measures has the Electoral Commission implemented or will implement to ensure that the stakeholders agree unanimously so the results are not in dispute?
Well, that's why we have involved the stakeholders from the beginning of the process. We met them yesterday. The delegation that is traveling, we had a meeting with them, and that included the Zambia Police and indeed the Anti-Corruption Commission and the Drug Enforcement Commission, plus the participating political parties. From the Commission's point of view and standpoint, we are involving the stakeholders from the beginning of this process, and as a way of building confidence in the process and as a demonstration that the Commission has nothing to hide. That is why we are getting them with us and taking them to Johannesburg to oversee that whole process. And when that process is complete, when the ballot papers have been printed, they will also see them dispatched. The political parties will be given an opportunity to receive these ballot papers in here in Lusaka at the airport. And from then on, we will involve them in the verification process of the ballot papers as they are verified district by district and constituency by constituency. And even as we distribute them from Lusaka now to the respective districts, we will, as much as possible, involve them. So the verification starts in Lusaka with the political parties, and when they reach the district, There also will be a team of officials at the district level to verify that indeed that these are the ones for the respective districts and indeed under the polling station.
Chris Akufuna is the spokesman for the Electoral Commission of Zambia. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. The Ugandan Renegade Army General David Sejusa recently returned home after months in a self-imposed exile abroad. This after demanding an inquiry into the alleged succession plan by President Yoweri Museveni to install his son as his successor. The government sharply disputes Sejusa's claim. Professor Amir Omara Otunu is the chairman of the Freedom and Unity Front, an umbrella opposition pressure group. General Sejusa, until recently, was part of this pressure group. Professor Otunu joins us live via telephone link up in the U.S. state of Connecticut. Hello, Professor Otunu.
Hello, my dear brother.
Your former colleague, General Sejusa, is saying that he's been transformed from Saul to Paul. As his former colleague, what do you make of this?
Actually, that was a phrase I used last year in November when we launched our manifesto. I appeal to Ugandans to think that perhaps Sejusa could be a soul on the way to Damascus and becoming Paul. Of course, we are not sure. We need to have the evidence before we can come to that conclusion. But the FUF is happy that he's back home, principally because as a human rights organization, that teaches inclusive approach to politics, we think he's entitled, as a Ugandan, to go back to his country of birth. There's nothing that should prevent any Ugandan to going back to our country of birth.
But Professor Otunu, why are opposition groups so far refusing to embrace him, despite his invitation to join them to fight against what he claims is the Museveni's rule?
I think that's very understandable. You may remember that the government passed what is known in Uganda as Public Management Order Bill, an act which actually circumscribes very severely freedom of movement, freedom of association, freedom of assembly. And you may remember that when the leading opposition leader, Kizza Besigye, tried to walk to work, he was each time brutally beaten up. And the question among most Ugandan opposition is simply this. If Kizza Besigye would be beaten up so brutally, how come General Sejusa goes back, is escorted by government officials, is not harassed at all? It is this which gives doubt in the minds of people. But I appeal to all the opposition who are skeptical to let time tell us when or whether he did not cut a deal with the government. He himself has said unequivocally that he did not cut a deal. I will see whether he did not cut a deal. And if he did not cut a deal, the question is why is the government not harassing him after he made scathing indictment of the government? That is the question.
So with the suspicions and distrusts and everything that appear to be going on against General Sejusa, do you think the opposition politicians are scared of associating with him?
Absolutely, because they're not sure. You may remember when he was in exile, he really gave an incredible, severe indictment of the government of Uganda, and now he went back. In fact, the government had accused him of treason. And the question in the minds of most opposition leaders in Uganda is if Kizza Besigye could be beaten up so brutally by making mild and principled criticism of the government, how come General Sejusa, who is given far more scathing indictment of government, giving details of some of the most brutal and heinous things they have done, would go back to the country and is left free? In fact, the president of Uganda, President Museveni, said that General Sejusa can choose the people who should protect him. That is what raises doubts in the minds of people. But I still think we need to wait and see what happens. Whichever way one takes this, it's fairly clear in the minds of most Ugandans that this suggests the government is at its weakest point in 30 years. It's out of weakness that it accepted the general back. without waiting is that it has changed the constitution.
But Professor Otunu, General Sejusa says he's still committed to ensuring that President Museveni leaves office. Does that say anything at all?
Well, it tells you that, you know, let me tell you one thing about General Sejusa. He's a very, very smart gentleman, very smart gentleman. And I'm very doubtful that General Sejusa would go back home if he thought and assessed that the risks were too high against him. So he must know exactly what he's doing. And my own interpretation is that he knows that the government is very weak. Because the government is very weak, the government will not do anything against him, because the government will need him to give the impression that it is tolerant, that it can welcome people who are critical to it. So I don't understand. General Sejusa is a very smart gentleman. I'm no doubt in my mind that he knows exactly what he's doing.
Thank you very much, Professor Amir Omar Otunu is the chairman of the Freedom and Unity Front, an umbrella opposition pressure group. He just spoke with me from stores in the U.S. state of Connecticut. As Zimbabwean Regional Minister Kodakwashe Basikiti is appealing to the government to rehabilitate the country's roads as the death toll this festive season continues to rise, Basikiti told VOA Studio 7's Blessing Zulu why it's important for the government to prioritize the rehabilitation and construction of roads in his Mazvingo province.
It's unfortunate that coupled to the narrowness of the road and the high volumes of cars congestion, which is currently obtaining, poor maintenance to the roads because there are potholes, delays in filling them up. But we believe, as government has indicated, that they shall be commencing on the dualization of that road. Will take off speedily and will avert the continuous loss of life through accidents in that road.
When is the dualization set to begin? Any date?
The Minister of Transport indicated that they will be starting dualization of the Masingo Bybridge Road next year. So it is our belief that they should be able to execute their plans simultaneously, realizing that this is the commercial highway road. The economy runs from the same road, but it's not maintaining it. And it's now resulted in lots of carnage and accidents.
But what is your advice to motorists this festive season, judging from the fact that road accidents in the province are on the increase?
My advice to motorists is that the current state of the road doesn't warrant even traveling at 120 kilometers per hour. They should maintain 60 kilometers per hour so that they reach where they are going safely, than to pretend the government authorized the speed limit 120 in Masingo Road does not obtain because the road is too bad.
Kodakwashe Basikiti is a Zimbabwean Mazvingo Provincial Affairs Minister. He spoke with VOA Studio 7's Blessing Zulu from Mazvingo.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.
VOA. Hello, I'm Douglas Mpuga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 1730 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 1730 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. Well, right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today.
Ay, punguza kidogo. na mengine kadhalika toto si unanielewa apo apo liposhika ukiongeza kidogo uweza kutongwa sweetie sweetie. Oh,
this the remix, yeah. The remix, yeah.
So fly.
Akon, P-Square, Mr. Maybe, Convict Music. First of all, you're the type of woman that stays on my mind. Walk down the street, every guy wanna jump on your behind. It's your seduction to make sure that we stay in line. Sexual corruption, cause I'll kill anyone for your time.
Dinner, tell you what, baby. We're supposed to live like family. Hey, I know the lie.
Know the lie.
There's nothing stopping me. She dey feel my swag and I get money. I dey try my best to be somebody. Cause I'm living life. She's girl, they make me higher, higher. I dey feel this, baby. You no go believe. This girl, I die, die. If you see this, baby, tell him say she must chop my money. Chop my money, chop my money, cause I don't care. Chop my money, chop my money, chop my money, cause I don't care. I don't care,
don't care.
I don't care,
don't care.
I don't care,
cause I get them plenty.
I don't care,
I don't care.
I don't care,
I don't care.
I don't care,
cause we know the empty.
Salt and stunt for you, you know I can. Farabaleko malole, omwele ake pepe. Tempe soro kilo shele. If you see her eyes, eyes, you don't go believe she's looking at me. Never ever run down, baby, and when I'm done, done, tell me if you want some more, baby, some more.
I got $20 in my name, 29 in my name, $20 in my name, in my name, in my name, $20 in my name, 29 in my name, $20 in my name, in my name, in my name, $20 in my name, 29.
Hey, hey,
in my name, 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 in
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Welcome, Afia. It's always a pleasure for me to share every week with the Voice of America my reflections on American foreign policy in Africa. And I, at the same time, pay close attention to African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States. This week, three issues are relevant for anyone who is interested in understanding President Obama's policy towards Africa and the international questions that have implications for Africa. For Americans who are particularly concerned about two issues, freedom of speech and the protection of the privacy of American individuals and people who deal with Americans. The Sony video scandal is certainly a big issue right now for many Americans who are looking at Hollywood and the American dream and the manner in which American entertainment, American understanding of the world is very much affected by three key pillars of American society. The Pentagon is very important to protect all of us from foreign enemies as well as internal enemies. Secondly, Hollywood, since World War I, has played a very important role in shaping African understanding of themselves and the manner in which they entertain themselves. Many of our major thinkers, writers, poets, and others have written volumes about Hollywood. So the Sony affair poses a serious issue, not only for the president as head of state and protection of American society, but it holds all the politicians from the top levels of the Senate all the way down to the rank and file congressmen in the country, and to all of us who are part of the American society. So this development is very international, and it has implications for Africa. Because I remember, as a young man growing up in Africa, we were very much attracted to American movies, B-movies, and American heroes like John Wayne, of course, someone who later became president, Ronald Reagan, and many of the people who are still remembered by Americans, Hopper Long Cassidy, Buck Jones, Billy the Kid, and Kansas Kid. These became great heroes in American society, and they affected African societies in terms of culture. So when America came to Africa, African kids who were going to schools in the 50s and 60s came to know many American icons from Hollywood. You have people like Natalia Wood, and of course, many others will be part of that galaxy. Marilyn Monroe and others. So that is one of the reasons why when the Sony affair developed, it has implications not only for Americans, Europeans, Latin Americans, Asians, and Africans. In this particular case, since we are looking at Africa, the Sony affair has implications because Americans were very much concerned about intellectual property, and of course, some of our graduate students wrote their dissertations on intellectual property. So when we talk about American policy towards Africa, this event perpetrated until it is fully proven by the North Koreans is not only against the Japanese, who are the source of Sunni, but Japanese-American relations as well. It has implications for Americans as well, and the Africans were also concerned about intellectual property and how intellectual property can be violated. Americans were very much worried about pirating, and that was one of the reasons why the Commerce Department was very much concerned about pirating of American property abroad. Today, unfortunately, this whole debate has gone to a higher level in the sense that the introduction of the Internet, which was originally done by the Pentagon, but then later on, because of capitalist transformation of the system, it is now used by all of us. Unfortunately, law enforcement, security people who used to be more concerned about the sociology of crime in the streets are now dealing with a mysterious element, the electron, the atom, and the manner in which the atom is beginning to save the lives of human beings. This is going to be debated by African broadcasters, African journalists, and many people who are sufficiently informed about this new technology called cyberspace. This is one issue. The other issue that is going to have implications with regard to the legacy of President Obama deals with the Cuban policy. The Cuban policy has three significance for Africans. One is during the Cold War, Cuba was just an island 90 miles away from the United States. Most Africans were very ignorant about Cuba. But Fidel Castro became part of the galaxy of the Third World political activists, and Africans are going to be part in that narrative. When the liberation movement in Africa started out, they were basically influenced by the first African to have a Nobel Peace Prize, Chief Albert Luthuli from South Africa, who was the first African to have a Nobel Peace Prize. Today we have almost a galaxy of Africans who received the Nobel Peace Prize. Cuba is going to enter the equation, and that is the emergence of Fidel Castro, who was unknown to Africans, but will become known to the Africans after the success of the Cuban Revolution, which coincided with 2 years after Ghana's independence, when Kwame Nkrumah became one of the leading Africans in the world, and Nkrumah will come to know Castro as a fellow traveler in the battle for socialism or freedom in the Third World. And this is how Kennedy's narrative and Nkrumah's narrative and Castro's narrative came together. And that was why Kwame Nkrumah became the first African to be invited to the White House. Why Kennedy was a fellow Catholic, and they were all young at that time. And Castro's story, which is now proverbial, because Castro and Che Guevara would be actively involved in decolonization. Che Guevara will end up in Congo, and his stories about Kabila are now proverbial, historical, and part of the narrative. So when we talk about President Obama's decision in Cuba, you have to look at that narrative against this background. That's the way it is today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as elders in South Africa say, copying everyone else all the time, the monkey one day cut his throat. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For over a decade, Georgia has worked toward strengthening its ties with the European Union. The country's government has made it clear that it believes its future lies in the West. In fact, both Georgia and the EU have a lot to gain from increased cooperation. The Georgian government is betting that a comprehensive trade agreement with the European Union will boost its economy. Georgia also launched negotiations for accession to the energy community in February 2014 and agreed to implement European Union energy legislation that will lead to closer ties with the European Union's single energy market. The energy community extends EU internal energy policy to Southeast Europe and the Black Sea region and creates a stable regulatory and market framework. Closer ties may help attract investments in Georgia's energy sector, potentially including new pipeline routes through Georgian territory, so Europe can more easily import oil and natural gas from Georgia's energy-rich neighbor Azerbaijan and from Central Asian energy producers such as Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. In late December, the European Parliament ratified an association agreement, as well as a deep and comprehensive free trade area with Georgia, which both had signed in June. The document creates a framework for cooperation between them. It commits Georgia to meeting a range of EU standards, including new customs regulations and quality controls, such as product health and safety standards. It also commits Georgia to reform its justice system with EU assistance, including aligning Georgia's laws with EU legislation. With EU assistance, Georgia will also strengthen its civil society institutions and organizations. Making these changes will not be easy, but in exchange, Georgia will gain greater access to the EU single market with its 500 million customers. In short, Georgia will gain market access into the EU in exchange for economic, political, and social reform commitments under the EU's Eastern Partnership Initiative. The United States congratulates Georgia on the European Parliament's ratification of the EU-Georgia Association Agreement, said State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki. The vote of support by hundreds of European parliamentarians in Strasbourg marks yet another important milestone in Georgia's Euro-Atlantic integration. The vote demonstrates Europe's growing confidence in Georgia and the country's continued pursuit of wide-ranging reforms, she said. The United States stands with the EU in our support of the Georgian people as they pursue these reforms and realize their integration.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.